Shale. Not just that the Death Star was our greatest mistake, but also that no truce will suffice. That will not slake the so-called New Republic's thirst for our blood. They've got it in their heads that we're monsters. It is decided. But that also means we cannot merely surrender. They'll want their taste of blood. Don't be surprised if the best of us get dragged out into the streets so we can be shot by some savage with a slug thrower.
Yes, Valco, Shale says. We know that you want to attack, 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 no matter how much it will cost us to do so.
He sniffs. So you'd rather lay down arms and bow your head for the executioner's axe? You wouldn't want to go out fighting?
This isn't some kind of inspirational story. Some scrappy ragtag underdog tale. Some pugilistic match where we're the good-hearted gladiator who brings down the oppressive regime that put him in the arena. They get to have that narrative. We are the ones who enslaved whole worlds full of alien inhabitants. We are the ones who built something called a Death Star under the leadership of a decrepit old goblin who believed in the dark side of some ancient insane religion.
Yup Tashu raises a quizzical academic eye toward her. Pandion just sneers.
Were this a better day, you'd be executed for treason, General Shale.
See? Shale says. We are the ones who do the executing, Grand Moff Pandion. If we surrender, the aberrant kindness of the New Republic may translate to us. We may get to keep our heads still.
She huffs.
Besides, we don't have a meaningful strategy of attack.
Of course we do, Pandion says with a laugh. Are you mad? The rebels, because that's what they are, rebels, criminals, deviants, did what they did with almost no war machine in place. Insurgents, all of them. They managed a few lucky shots with their slingshots, but we still have the ships, the men, the training.
He points to arson.
The money.
Then why do governors turn away from us every day? Why do we lose more ships every week? Why do we see holovids of freed worlds throwing parades and tearing down statues? They did so much with so little, Pandion. You misunderstand our place in history.
Then we do much with little. Besides,
he waves his hand dismissively.
Those holovids are propaganda, and you damn well know it. The reality is, the Rebel Alliance doesn't have the resources to keep control of this galaxy. But we still do. And
here he turns toward Ray Sloane.
Let's not forget, we still possess a super Star Destroyer. Isn't that right, Admiral Sloane? Or do we possess it? Perhaps only you possess it. Perhaps you're being a greedy little child who doesn't want to share your fleet with the rest of the Academy.
An expected commentary. One he's been making again and again since they began this thing. Ray says the same thing she says every time he brings it up. The Ravager and its fleet are at the disposal of the Galactic Empire, Valco. The question remains, he echoes her response even as she speaks it, though with a considerably more mocking tone.
The question remains, what even is the Empire at this juncture, and who controls it? Yes, I'm aware of your stance. I just want the room to be aware that you're the one with your finger curled around the trigger of our greatest weapon, and yet you keep it hidden. Well, we don't even know where, do we?
Your spies haven't served you that slice of the pie yet, hmm?
She says, putting a small curl at the corners of her lips. Pandion starts to protest, but she wants to control this meeting, so control it she does.
This meeting is to decide the fate of the Empire with the input of several advisors, not just one. If I wanted to take the Ravager and seize control, I could make that attempt, and I might even manage it. but I'd rather not make the same mistakes as in the past. Now, Grand Moff, we have heard from you. We know your position. Again and again. One person we have not heard from is you, Advisor Tashu. Would you enlighten us?
Tashu looks up once more as if all this is a distraction.
Oh, yes, yes, of course.
Tashu was a close advisor and a friend, as much as one could be, apparently, to the former Emperor Palpatine. The man who was once senator, and then chancellor, and the man whom rumors said was also a dark Sith lord. Amid the Empire, the presence of the Sith was less a fact and more a myth. A few spoke of it as being possible, but most believed it to be concoction. Palpatine would not be the first ruler to invent stories of himself as if he were of cosmic import. The history crons say that a regent of the Old Republic, Hylomane Lightbringer, claimed he was born in the dust of the Tymphonic Nebula, and could not be killed by mortal weapons. A fact proven untrue when he was indeed killed by a mortal weapon, bludgeoned by a chair, apparently. Palpatine's legend extended, too, to his enforcer, the brutish Darth Vader. Sloane believes their powers to be real, though perhaps not as omnipotent as Palpatine would have preferred everyone believe. It is then no surprise that Tashu cleaves to those ways when he speaks. He says,
"You chastise the dark side as if it is an evil path, laughable for its malevolence. But do not confuse it with evil, and do not confuse the light as being the product of benevolence. The Jedi of old were cheats and liars, power-hungry maniacs operating under the guise of a holy monastic order, moral crusaders whose diplomacy was that of the lightsaber. The dark side is honest. The dark side is direct. It is the knife in the front rather than the one stuck in your back. The dark side is self-interested, yes, but it is about extending that interest outward, to yourself, but then beyond yourself. Palpatine cared about the galaxy. He did not wrest control simply to have power for himself. He already had power as Chancellor. He wanted to take power from those who abused it. He wanted to extend control and safety to the people of all worlds. That came with costs. He knew them and lamented them, but paid them just the same, because the dark side understands that everything has a cost, and the cost must always be paid."
A moment of silence. Then Pandion snort laughs. Rey thinks,
"If the Emperor was still around, that single utterance would earn Pandion the loss of his head. That's the cost that would be paid for such treasonous disdain."
The Moth holds up a hand and operates it like a babbling puppet.
"You say all these words, Advisor Tashu, and yet none of them sound like they have any bearing on..."
Another snort laugh.
"Anything at all."
Tashu offers a beatific, self-assured smile.
"What I mean to say is that Palpatine was a smart man. Smarter than the combination of all of us here. We must emulate his path. The Emperor knew the dark side was his savior. And so we, too, must make the dark side ours."
"Huh," Shale grumps. "And how do we do that? I don't think any of us are trained in the ways of the Force."
"No Sith remain,"
Tashu says.
"And the lone Jedi that exists, the son of Anakin Skywalker, possesses an untouchable soul, at least for now. We must instead move toward the dark side. Palpatine felt that the universe beyond the edges of our maps was where his power came from. Over the many years, he, with our aid, sent men and women beyond known space. They built labs and communication stations on distant moons, asteroids, out there in the wilds. We must follow them. Retreat from the galaxy. Go out beyond the veil of stars. We must seek the source of the dark side, like a man looking for a wellspring of water.
Crassus twists up his pudgy, jowly face so much it looks like a wrung rag.
You're saying we leave? We pack up our ships and run away? Like fearful little children, afraid of Daddy's belt?
Not fearful, Tashu says. Hopeful.
And from there, a brand new fusillade of arguments rise up. This time from each corner, all at the same time. A cacophony of the same arguments. Truce, money, surrender, cold war, hot war. All of it nonsense. None of them agree. Sloane wonders if ever they will. Which means this summit was a foolish endeavor. But we still have to try. The Galactic Empire is a broken mirror. Many reflections of itself, shattered and separate. Sloane tells herself, it's up to me to repair the glass, to fix the reflection. She believes in the Empire, and she believes that she is the one who can and must fix it. An ascendant Empire will again rule the galaxy, and her place in it will be cemented. No longer kept to the margins, no longer left off the ledger. Sloane will matter. She stands up.
Please continue. I'll be back.
They don't even notice that she leaves. She's not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. In the space above Akiva, a Viper probe droid decelerates with cautious bursts from its retrothrusters. When finally it stabilizes, its five spider-like limbs extend outward. Its eye glows. A series of small antennas emerge from the top of its domed head, all meant to take measurements. It begins its scans. A hard hand cups under his chin, moves his head up, back, left, right. The flat of this intrusive hand slaps his cheek. Not hard, just pat, pat, pat. Wedge inhales sharply, his eyes open. It's her, the one who caught him at the communication station, the one who put a blaster round in his back.
What now?
He says.
Come to torture me yourself?
The other one, the one with the pale face and the dark wrinkles, skin marked with bold striations as if he were half dead, isn't here. But he appears now and again. Maybe once an hour, though it's hard to say because time is slippery. It's always just as Wedge starts to sleep again. And this strange man, he hurts Wedge whenever he shows. He cut into Wedge's side with a knife. No deep slashes, always shallow cuts. He thrust a spark prod against the inside of Wedge's thigh, and when he did, everything inside Wedge lit up like a malfunctioning console. One time he just came in and noisily ate fruit. At no time has he said anything. Then he just licked his fingers. The other times he just chuckled quietly as he delivered pain. But this one, this woman, an admiral, isn't she?
No,
she says. I'm not a torturer.
No,
he wheezes.
Of course not. You're the questioner.
I thought so, but I'm not sure.
Nearby, the medical droid checks the tube that winds around his arm and plunges into the skin.
You wouldn't answer me anyway, would you?
No,
Wedge says. He tries to put some carbon steel in his voice. He tries not to let his fear creep into that word.
If she senses fear, she'll pounce. Tear into him like a wampa scenting blood on the snow.
But he is scared. He came all this way, through countless battles in space, over snow, across desert and swamp and open sky. And now, at the end of it, he's here, wounded and strapped upright to a table, tortured to death. It wouldn't matter anyway. I ask you about vital New Republic details, ship movements, base locations, attack plans. What could I do with it? Not much, I'm afraid.
Ready to surrender yet?
He says, giving her a smile. It's not a kind smile. It's cruel. He means for it to hurt.
I'm laughing at you,
he thinks. Let me ask you this. Why?
Why what?
Why be a rebel? Why join?
To destroy the Empire.
She shakes her head.
No, too easy. That's just the paint. Scratch off the color. There's something personal underneath it.
He again shows her his teeth, bared in a terrible smile.
Of course there is, Admiral. The Empire hurt people close to me. Family, friends, a girl I loved once. And I'm not alone. All of us in the New Republic, we all have stories like that.
He coughs. His eyes water.
We're the harvest of all the horrible seeds you planted.
But we kept order in a lawless galaxy.
And you did it with a closed fist instead of an open hand.
You have a way with words for just a pilot.
He tries to shrug, but even that hurts. A grunt comes from the back of his throat, and he bites back any further cry. The woman nods, and then turns and leaves without another word. Ensign Deltura's head hovers above the table, a blue glow surrounding the hologram. Akbar leans forward at the table.
You're quite certain, Ensign?
No sign of Imperial ships, Admiral.
But you did find signs of your own.
Just debris. Nothing you'd find with the human eye, but the Viper is a surprisingly effective probe droid. It found molecular remnants indicative of our own ships. Yes, sir.
The A-Wings.
Akbar hmms.
Something shot them down.
Something from the surface, sir?
Unlikely. Couldn't hit an A-Wing from that distance.
Akbar's long, webbed fingers mesh together. They rub against one another. He turns his chair to the other person in the room. This person, also a hologram. And this hologram is only barely a person. The image stands there, off to the side, like a ghost. The body and face shifting and distorting, shadowy and unclear. This is their inside man, an informant known only as the Operator. So far, his intel has been trustworthy, impeccably so, which makes Akbar all the more dubious.
What say you, Operator?
The voice that emerges is as distorted as the visual, a mechanized, warped sound.
Does the droid detect any traffic in and out of the capital city? Or around the planet at all?
To Deltura, Akbar says,
You heard the question?
No, sir. No ships at all.
The Operator says,
Have the droid ping all the comm relays planetside. See what happens.
Deltura nods, says something to someone outside holorange, likely his science officer, a young Togruta woman. Moments of uncomfortable silence spread out, like something noxious spilling across the floor. Akbar likes none of this. A septic feeling sits inside him, sucking up all the optimism he had possessed. The ensign's glowing holographic head returns.
Nothing,
he says, almost shocked.
Nothing, sir. The probe droid cannot ping any of the relays. It's like they're dead.
Communications blackout. An Imperial trick. They are there, Admiral Akbar. Their ships must be in hiding. But if no traffic is coming in and out, they've instituted a blockade. No ships, no communications. Something is happening. I do not know what.
Thank you,
Akbar says.
You will act on this?
The operator asks.
Eager. Too eager.
Akbar doesn't answer. He turns off the hologram. Deltora asks.
Is there anything you want me to do, sir?
Hold position,
Akbar says.
I need time to think and confer with the others. Thank you, Ensign.
Admiral, sir.
The man's face disappears. Worry gnaws at Akbar like a school of brine maggots. He needs time to think. But too much time, and they could miss a vital opportunity. Or, he thinks, escape the jaws of yet another Imperial trap. Is this a ruse, or is this the real thing? Could be a secret meeting. There, an irony too bold to ignore. Once it was the rebels who had to sneak around and hide their presence. Now it's the Empire. The roles are reversing. A sign of their nascent victory over Imperial oppression, perhaps. But he worries, too, about their overconfidence. The Empire isn't gone. Not yet. It's waiting to strike again. Of that, he's quite sure.
Interlude. Chandrila.
A purple fruit comes from off-camera and crashes into the side of Olea Choco's face. The fruit pops. Juice runs down her cheek and drips from her jawline. She looks stunned. From off-screen, an angry voice.
Boo! Boo to the Galactic Senate! Boo to the New Republic!
Another fruit flies. This one misses its mark, sailing over Olea's head. Tracine starts to say...
Okay, Lug, time to cut.
No, Olea says, interrupting. She swallows hard and wipes some of the goopy fruit innards from her cheek.
You, the protester, come closer.
Tracine gives Lug a barely perceptible nod. A pair of scaly Trandoshan hands appear at the edges of the screen and pivot the hovering camera toward a small Zan man in a dirty gray jumpsuit. He has a small basket of fruits and vegetables, mostly rotten. He is alone. He sees the camera is pointed at him, and he waves his hands.
No, I do not want to be on camera, please.
Olea approaches, gingerly, hands out, beseeching.
If you have concerns, then I'd like to hear them.
The Zan stammers, looking around, as if this is some kind of joke, or as if... he wasn't prepared to have this effect.
I am sorry. I should go.
He starts to pull away, but Tracine steps in front of him.
You can have your say.
Suspicious, he says.
Really?
Olea answers.
Really? Tell me your troubles.
To the camera, Tracine mouths.
Are we still on?
A reptilian thumbs up appears for a moment on the screen. The alien begins.
I am Giska Dotalo. I am from Gan Moradir, colony in the Mid-Rim. The New Republic came. They destroyed an Imperial base. Now the Imperials are gone. The Empire was cruel, but at least there was order. We had food and water. Things worked. Now the rebels have gone, and the gangs have come. The pirates... we don't have enough food. The destruction affected our worlds, and...
he begins to sob.
We saved up enough credits to bring me here. I am all we have.
For a moment, Olea seems struck dumb. Tracine looks like she's about to intervene, but then Olea speaks.
It's good you came, Mr. Dotalo. I don't believe Gan Moradir has a representative yet in the Senate. Today... you'll be that representative.
His eyes go wider than seems possible.
What?
War is terrible, and an army isn't enough to fix problems. We need a solution for what happens after they do their job. And that's why the Senate is beginning again, and why we're doing it here, on the Chancellor's homeworld. Some think of this place as a small, inconsequential world. But Chandrila has always been an origin point for big ideas, and the citizens to carry them to the larger galaxy beyond. The galaxy needs help. It needs those big ideas. But like you say, it needs the smaller things too. Food, water, shelter. Basic things. And after war is over, there has to be something else to fix what's broken. I invite you today to speak to the Senate about your people and your colony. Let them listen. Let us help you.
She summoned someone from off camera, another Pantoran, a man in blue administrative robes. Olea whispers to him. She makes a small introduction between him and Giska Dotalo. Then the Pantoran man gently urges him away. Tracine smiles and calls,
"Cut!"
But her eyes flit to the distance, because there's a commotion now. People are looking up and away. Tracine motions with her hand, and Lug spins the camera. Over in the distance, a line of Imperial prisoners, cuffed together, shepherded along by a New Republic officer.
"This is unacceptable!"
Olea hisses, then darts off to intervene. Chapter 16. Bad dreams. It's one of the classics. One of the dreams that replays inside Nora's head now and again. It's her and her Y-Wing and her astromech, R5-G4. And they're in the twisting bowels of the Death Star again. She breaks off from the main conduit, drawing a handful of TIEs after her like flies on a Gorth's tail. She can't swat them, can't bat them away, can't outfly them. And suddenly, there are more ahead of her, and the inside of the battle station is a maze looping back on itself. And from somewhere she feels the concussive shock of the power source going up. And then everything starts to fall apart around her, and the fire fills the space behind her. And then it's there at the front, too, rushing up to greet her. She wakes up, bathed in sweat, like she always does, no matter how warm or cold the air. Nora checks her watch. She has, of course, been asleep for less than an hour. After rescuing her son from the clutches of that vile gangster, she's still got the feeling like they're being chased. Heart pounding, muscles tight, jaw set, adrenaline cooking through her like liquid blaster fire. Sleep was a bad idea. Nora heads downstairs to get some tea. She expects that everyone is still asleep, and here she reminds herself to thank her sister Esmel for letting this crew of curious strangers stay the night. But as she descends, she hears voices coming from the kitchen. There, gathered around a small table, are the two curious strangers, Jazz Imari and Singier Rathvelis. They've set aside Esmel's hydrodome, where she grows small herbs like heartweed and synthin seed, and have set out across the small table a series of odd objects. A salt cellar, a series of herb vials, a napkin dispenser, a bunch of quick sticks, and fruit knives. She enters, and the two of them straighten up, like children who have done wrong.
What's all this?
Nora asks.
Nothing,
Jazz says.
Just playing a game,
the other one, Singier, says with a smile. A strange couple, these two. She, a cold-faced, kirk-tongued Zabrak. He's a tall drink of milk. A bit rangy, scruffy, the smell of wine or brandy leaving his pores. He's got a big, duplicitous grin. She's got eyes cut like stones. Nora mumbles something, and then taps the button on the side of the kettle. From the upper cabinet, she selects a geisha tea, measures some into a cup. The other two are staring holes in her back. The kettle whistles, and she pours. Ghosts of steam rise around her. Then she turns and says,
"That looks like a map."
"It's not," Singier says, still smiling.
"It is,"
the Zabrak says at almost the same time.
"Will you tell me what it is?"
Nora asks.
"No."
The other two both answer in unison. Jazz and Sinjir give each other a look. A bit quizzical. A bit amused, that shared look. Nora leans over, scrutinizes their arrangement.
This, the napkin dispenser. It's bigger than everything else, so it's meant to represent something big. The satrap's palace, I'm guessing. Which lines up with the rest. Here's the old capitol building. Here's the avenue of the satrapy. Here's the narrow Withrafisp road. This was once a secret road, I'm told, to sneak satraps in and out of the palace. But it's been public since I was a girl.
Nope!
Sinjir says, feigning total sincerity.
Sorry! Thank you, though, for playing. Now, if you'll excuse us...
Shut up,
Jazz says to him. Then to Nora.
Yes, you're right. Did you grow up here?
Nora nods.
I did.
You're...
Jazz gives her a look over.
A rebel?
Am I that obvious?
The Zabrak shrugs.
No, but I'm no fool. You had no problem shooting at stormtroopers last night. And yet you don't look like another criminal. Or just another local. You dress like a rebel. The utilitarian vest. The utility belt. Those boots.
She squints.
Pilot?
Nora laughs.
Yes, that's correct.
I'm a bounty hunter,
Jazz says.
I'm here collecting a bounty for the New Republic. I think I could use your help.
Wait one starburn second,
Sinjir protests, waving both hands.
You're cutting me in for a meager 25%, and now you're going to water down the bounty even more by bringing her in?
The bounty hunter says,
I'm hoping she'll do it because it's the right thing, and because it is an attack on the Empire, not because of credits.
Nora feels the call of duty crawling over her like ants. She wants to find out more, wants to throw in and spit in the eye of the Empire. But I can't, she says, speaking through clenched jaw.
I really can't. My son and I have to leave this planet. My first priority is taking him away.
Go save your friend,
Temin says.
And Tilly's, because I told you I'm not going.
Temin shuffles into the kitchen.
And by the way, I know you people think you're not being loud, but you're totally being loud.
Nora catches his arm.
I'll let someone else save Captain Antilles. My job isn't fighting this war anymore. My job is you.
But he pulls away from her. He grabs a glass of blue milk from the cold chest.
Did my droid come home yet? He should be here by now.
Nora wants to keep fighting him, but she bites her tongue. He's as stubborn as she is. Pushing him is like punching a wall. She'll only break her hand trying. Sinjir says to the boy,
that was your droid, huh?
Yeah.
That was a battle droid.
I know.
They're the most inept fighting unit in perhaps the history of the galaxy. And trust me, stormtroopers are basically just overturned mop buckets with guns. Especially these days.
Do not sell the stormtroopers short,
Jazz snaps.
In number, they are dangerous.
So are swamp buffalo,
Sinjir says.
It doesn't mean they're particularly effective. Battle droids, even less so. Kudos to you, young man, turning one of them into a bona fide war machine.
Sinjir softly applauds.
Though I think it's wise to prepare for the eventuality that they overwhelmed him. He's a battle droid, not a technological miracle.
Yeah, well...
Temin stands there, looking surly, sipping his drink.
You don't know Borcat's scat from Dubak dung, pal. Mr. Bones is programmed with... Well, just trust me. Mr. Bones will be just fine.
Nora watches her son, the way he stands with his fists balled up, his brow furrowed. He's angry. Like she was. And maybe still is, she admits to herself. But then his eyes narrow, and he looks down at the table.
What's this?
Nothing,
Sinjir says.
It's a map,
Tenmin says. And Nora swells with small pride. A pride that grows as Tenmin adds,
What's this? The Satrap's palace?
By all the damned stars, Sinjir says. Like mother, like son.
The boy frowns at that. Nora feels stung. Jazz Imari then jumps in with both feet.
Right now at that palace, provided we have not missed our opportunity, a secret meeting is taking place. At this meeting are a small number of very important individuals within the Imperial ranks. Movers and shakers. High bounty values.
She lists those individuals. Moff Falco Pandion, Admiral Ray Sloan, Advisor Yup Tashu, General Jilia Shale, and the bounty hunter's original target, the banker and slaver, Arson Crassus.
That's it,
Nora says, snapping her fingers. Part of her feels like she should have figured this out already. But then another part of her, a realistic side, or maybe just the cynical side, says she's just some pilot. How would she have known?
Still, it all adds up. The Star Destroyers, the blockade, the comm blackout. They're protecting this meeting. And Wedge.
The Zabrak raises an eyebrow.
What is a Wedge?
Wedge Antilles, Sinjir says. Right? Pilot for the Rebel Alliance?
Nora nods.
Yes. How did you know?
The man hesitates.
I'm a rebel, too.
That strikes her as odd. He is dressed a bit like one, but something about him feels off somehow. Still, the rebellion is home to all kinds. Nora continues.
They must have him. Wedge. He was probably scouting the Outer Rim and ran afoul of whatever this is.
He's probably still alive,
Jazz says.
Which means you have an opportunity. Help me, we will strike a blow for your new republic. We will undo the efforts of the Empire, cutting their hamstrings just as they're relearning how to stand. You will rescue your friend.
Again, duty swarms Nora. The chance to do right. But the opposing feeling rises true, too. For once, she just wants to keep her head down, her chin to her chest, and duck all incoming fire. She doesn't want to fly into the belly of the beast. Not this time.
No,
she says, staring down below her darkening brow.
The best way forward is to get off this planet. Soon as we get into calm range, we alert the Republic. They send in ships and troops and...
The bounty hunter interrupts.
Wrong. By then the meeting will have concluded, if it hasn't already, and your friend will either be gone or dead. The way forward is now. The work is ours to do.
I'm in, Tenmin says, but I want a cut.
Young man, Sinjir says, chuckling. Let's not overreach. We dutifully saved your little can from getting kicked.
Fine,
Jazz Imari says to the boy.
You can have half of his cut.
She tilts her thorny head, gesturing towards Sinjir. Sinjir objects.
Hey!
You'll still get passage off this planet,
the Zabrak woman says. She gives a haughty little flip. The axe blade slice of hair between her thorns suddenly falls to the side of her scalp.
And the bounty is significant enough that even a fraction will buy you enough otherworldly liquors to keep you pickled until the New Republic once more becomes the Old Republic. Take the deal, or leave it.
He rolls his eyes.
Fine.
I don't know about this,
Nora says.
I could use your help. I bet your friend could as well.
Nora hesitates. It's like being a kid again, and jumping off one of the waterfalls in a car canyon. She literally has to hold her breath before she says,
I'm in, but I want passage off this planet too.
Done,
Jazz says.
Now, I think we should...
The whole house shakes. Someone's at the door. As Jazz pulls her blaster, the memory once more comes rushing back to meet Nora. coming at her fast as the silver water after jumping off one of those waterfalls. That sound. Fists pounding on the door. The sound of Imperials coming to take her husband away.
Chapter 17. Around the table sit three figures of flesh and blood and two holograms. Those present, Admiral Akbar, Commander Kirsta Agate, and Captain Saf Melor. The two holograms, General Krix Maydeen, and the newly appointed Chancellor of the New Republic, Mon Mothma. All of them look tired and worried. Akbar suspects he appears much the same. Everything feels to him on a pivot, balanced on the blade of a knife. Like it could go one way, or with the barest breeze, it could fall back to the other side. A razor's edge of possibility, good and bad.
"Are we sure we can trust this informant?"
Maydeen says. He scratches at his prodigious white beard. The lines in his face, seen even here in the hologram, appear deeper than ever.
"So far," Agate answers, "all signs point to yes."
Akbar interjects.
"But we also must recognize the Empire's ability to play the long game. Our victory over Endor was fortunate, but the Empire orchestrated that trap with great patience."
"Send in a fleet,"
Melor says. The Serene captain carries a certain haughtiness with him. His head, tall and rigid, a frustrated and dubious brow that extends upward to demonstrate excess incredulity.
"Two light cruisers, a contingent of fighters from Gold Squadron, and see what's there. If there's a fight, the fleet will be ready for it."
Mon Mothma speaks.
"We must be cautious. Inroads to the Outer Rim are slow. Further, this is a time of relative peace. But that peace rests uncomfortably on very unstable ground. An incursion of that magnitude could be seen as overly aggressive. We must be seen as friends, not intruders. Occupying the airspace over Akiva could be trouble."
Melor shakes his head.
"Chancellor, and congratulations, by the way. Akiva is, with all due respect, no feather in anyone's cap. It is a marginal planet at best, and the satrapy is in the Empire's pocket. They produce resources we do not require, and the old droid factory beneath the city has been out of use for decades. As such, Akiva offers us very little strategic advantage or concern."
"But the people there are our concern,"
Mon Mothma says. Akbar detects that her hackles have been raised. Melor does that sometimes. He's from a military family, and though he carries some of that Saurian intellectual arrogance, his aggression is well known. Mon continues.
"And we have intelligence that suggests our messaging has gotten through there. The people are ready for a change. The New Republic is that change."
Melor starts to speak, but once more Akbar interjects.
"I am in accord with the Chancellor here. This is a fragile peace, and we must be wary of any ruse set before us. General Maydeen, do you think you could put together a strike team? Small, 5 to 7 Republic soldiers?"
"I think that's doable. You want them on the ground?"
"Mm-hmm,"
Akbar says.
"A suborbital landing squad. Special forces. Drop from high atmosphere. We need reports from on the ground. This seems the most opportune way to do it. Small but effective. Can we all agree on that?"
Nods all around, except from Melor. The captain frowns, puckering his lips as if he's about to object, but then he sighs and nods as well.
"Good. Let's get this in motion. I want boots on the ground in 6 hours. Sooner if we can manage it. Thank you all."
Chapter 18.
Jazz wings the door open. Blaster up. A droid stands there in the early morning rain.
It's a B-1 battle droid. The B-1 battle droid. The bodyguard Temen calls Mr. Bones. Rain hits the servo motor in its exposed skull, sparking and turning to steam as it does. Temen rushes past Jazz. The droid, painted red and black, laughs maniacally, a warped, mechanized sound. It raises its one arm. The other is now missing. And all the little animal bones that dangle from it rattle and clack. The droid gives a robot thumbs up.
Bones!
Temen says, throwing his arms around the droid.
I performed violence,
the droid warbles. Jazz wonders if that's pride she hears in the thing's discordant voice.
Roger, roger!
Then a shower of sparks erupts from its head. Its eyes go dark. It falls to the side like a felled tree. Temen makes a sad sound in the back of his throat. Sinjir peeks past and says,
I think that thing has seen better days, boy.
Quiet!
The kid snaps.
You hurt his feelings. He just needs work. Help me get him inside.
It's night, you know, comes a voice.
Wedge, magnetically shackled to the table, startles awake. The dream he was in, a dream of being out in space in a broken fighter, the oxygen failing, his astromech blown to slag, the ship drifting through the void, falls apart in his hands like wet sand gone suddenly dry. The voice, it's coming from the strange man. The man whose age is hard to tell. The one with the dark striations that aren't quite wrinkles, with the beady eyes and serpent smile. The one who cuts Wedge with the knife. Right now, though, he sees no knife. Just the man clasping his hands within the bundled, puffy sleeves of his robe.
You're here for more torture? I won't break.
The man's spooky smile never wavers.
I know. I can see that. I can see your vitality will never waver.
He thrusts up a finger, as if having an epiphany. But the epiphany is not his own. Rather, he seems to wish to deliver one.
Did you know that Sith lords could sometimes drain the Force energy from their captives? Siphoning life from them and using it to strengthen their connection to the dark side. Extending their own lives as well, so that they could live for centuries beyond their intended expiration.
You fancy yourself some kind of wizard?
The man tut-tut-tuts.
Hardly. I am Tashu, merely a historian. An eager student of the old ways. And, until recently, an advisor to Palpatine.
My friend Luke told me some things about him.
Tashu's grin broadens, showing off his two white teeth.
Yes, I imagine he did. Seen through the lens of a confused, naive boy, most assuredly.
His fingers pluck at the air, like a spider testing its webs.
I know I won't break you physically.
So why come here at all?
To keep you from sleeping well. And to help break you mentally. It may not yield us any information, but I like to practice.
I'm a pilot. I'm used to not sleeping.
Yes, but you're not used to hopelessness. Look around. You're locked away, tortured without function. The Empire, even now, is resurging here in this very palace. Your new Republic has a moment to breathe and gain its footing, but we have a war machine. We have the blessings of the dark side. And even if your people continue to march forward, reclaiming system after system, we will be waiting. In some form or another. The Empire is just a skin we wear, you see. A shell. It's not just about law and order. It's about total control. We will always come back for it.
No matter how hard you work to beat us back, we are an infection inside the galaxy's bones. And we will always surge forth when you least expect it.
You're wrong,
Wedge says, gritting his teeth.
The galaxy is home to good people. There's more of us than there are of you.
It's not about numbers or percentages. It's about faith. The few of us have infinitely more faith than the many of you.
I have faith in the New Republic.
Tashu chuckles.
And that faith will be tested.
Your faith will be tested when I kick in your teeth!
There it is,
Tashu says, snapping his fingers so hard it sounds like a bird's neck breaking.
A vital spike of anger and hate, born of the hopelessness I've planted in you. A terrible little seed. I can't wait for it to grow its wretched tree and bear its ugly fruit.
Interlude. Coronet City, Corellia. Lightning flashes, and the fight continues. On the roof of the old holoplex, against the backdrop of a bright, gaudy, ever-shifting billboard of advertisements, two men battle. They've been here for so long now, all sense of time has escaped them. They're tired, bedraggled, soaked by the rains that came through and have gone again. But they keep going at it. The older one, thick, slovenly, his body encased in loose, rust-red armor, his head swaddled in rain-sodden wraps, circles. Both of his hands up in club-like fists. A line of blood snakes from his nose, and he licks it away, then grins like a drunk.
We can quit this charade any time, mate,
Dengar growls.
We can sit down, have a proper pint somewhere, talk over the agreement.
No agreement, says the other man,
the one who calls himself Mercurial Swift. He's young, agile, no armor at all. Dark hair now plastered to his pale brow. In his hands, a pair of batons. He gives them a twirl.
You gotta give this up, Dengar. You're reaching past the stars on this one. A fool's crusade.
At that, Dengar rushes in again, swinging fists like hammers. Like he doesn't just want to punch the younger, faster man, but wants to pulp him like a fruit for his morning juice. Mercurial catches a fist to his collarbone, and pain shoots up his neck and down his arm. One of his batons clatters against the rooftop, splashing into a puddle. Mercurial cartwheels the other way. When Dengar moves to follow, the younger bounty hunter ducks and pistons the end of his baton in the gap between Dengar's armor plates, right into his ribs. The older thug howls and staggers back, clutching his side. His smile is somehow a scowl at the same time.
Join me. You're good. You're fast, but dumb. Real dumb. Just look at you. Green is fresh Dohaki spice. You need a guiding hand.
From you? Mercurial asks with a coughing scoff. I can't see that happening, old man.
Another flash of lightning. No thunder.
Don't you get it? I got into this gig because I like being alone. I like the rogue thing.
He laughs, a curiously melodic sound.
I didn't become a bounty hunter so I could join a club, eh?
Dengar begins to circle again. Mercurial circles the other way, toward his lost baton.
We've always been a club,
Dengar shouts.
Maybe that's what's been holding you back. Other hunters always scooping up the bounties before you, beating you to the punch.
There, at Mercurial's feet, the baton. He kicks it up into his hand.
Ho, ho, ho. You think I've lost a step, huh?
Can't lose a step you never had.
Dengar guffaws.
You little scrap muncher! I was putting away bounties while you were still in your space diapers!
What does it say about you that you're still in your space diapers?
You don't like me much, do you?
You want it point blank? You're a strange, gross old man. Heart of the moon, truth on my sleeve. Nobody's ever liked you.
There. That got him. Dengar's like a crazy beast. You just have to wave the right bait in front of his nose to get him to charge. And charge he does, thundering forward like a starving pack animal. But then, at the last moment, he jukes left. The older bounty hunter dives across the roof and tucks into a roll. When he springs back up on the other side, he spins around and his particle array gun is in his hand, ready to scatter Mercurial's atoms across the flashing billboard. Again, the fight pauses. Mercurial with his hands up. Dengar on one knee with the wide mouth of the array gun pointed. This time they're silent. Tension drawn out like strangling cord. Lightning flashes again. Dengar's finger hovers near the trigger. The gun hums. Mercurial's hands tighten around the batons. Something is about to break. Something has to break. Or Dengar's going to shoot him. Mercurial's eyes flash to a nearby rooftop. His eyes go wide. His jaw slack. He summons the image in his mind and says,
Boba Fett!
Dengar wheels toward the rooftop, the gun barrel turning. And that is Mercurial's opportunity. He flings one of the batons. It cracks Dengar on the top of his forehead as soon as he whips his head back around. As his skull snaps back, Mercurial is already leaping forward and driving a knee into the side of the old bounty hunter's face. Then an elbow against his collarbone, a baton against his wrist. The gun drops. Mercurial picks it up and jams the barrel under Dengar's chin. Just as fresh rain begins to fall, a spitting, flecking rain, Dengar winces.
You're good.
I've been told.
That trick back there. Maybe I have lost a bloody step, mate.
Mercurial shrugs.
I used to be an actor and a dancer.
No fooling, Dengar croaks. What turned you to this life?
The Empire doesn't much care for the performing arts.
True that. True that.
Dengar sniffs a bubble of blood back up his nose and sneers.
But all that's more to the point, isn't it? Things are changing now. Our profession is about to get marginalized, too. Those rebels won't put up with our special brand of sauce for too long, will they? That's why we got a band together. Form a proper union. We'll be a force to reckon with. We'll look all official-like.
I'll take my chances alone.
Dengar nods.
Okay. You gonna kill me?
No bounty on you. Why bother?
You watch. That day will come. Bounties on the bounty hunters. We'll see it soon enough. Even in my lifetime. Just you watch.
Mercurial nods, takes the gun away.
Take care, Dengar.
Not likely, kid. Not bloody likely.
Chapter 19.
It's morning, and Adia waits for Admiral Sloan. Adia realizes that in the grand scheme of things, she is of little import. An attaché, an assistant. She hands papers, fetches cups of caff, asks for signatures, delivers communications. But one day, maybe she'll be something more. This is a glorious time to be alive. The Empire is reeling. That is itself not a good thing. But in those cracks and fractures waits opportunity. Every crack is a place where Adia can ease the tip of her foot. She can widen those gaps and find a place for herself in there. It's why she admires Sloan so much. The Admiral understands. The Admiral is making the best of this situation. And right now, Adia has bad news to deliver. That thrills her, honestly. It shouldn't, probably.
Bad news is, by its designation, declaratively and objectively bad. But it's the reaction that matters. People are made under duress. They are formed by crisis. Adia grew up on Coruscant, but her parents were not important people. Her father was a welder. Not so low that they had to work in the bowels of the city world. He worked prime jobs for the Empire, but he still got his hands dirty. And burned, and cut. Until one day there were arthritic claws of scar tissue and callus. She always marveled how the laser welders could make or break things, how they could join pieces together or cut them apart. This is like that. Crisis will bring them all together or destroy them. But she believes that Sloane will be made by this crisis. Not just this small one she's about to hand deliver, but the larger crisis. She admires Sloane greatly. She would hate to disappoint the Admiral. Ray stands under the spray of an ice-cold shower. Piped in straight from the canyon, the satrap said. The purest water you will find on Akiva. The old Ahaya Ko people believed the water was so pure, it could take from you your sins and leave you a better person. If only that were true. She keeps the water cold because that's how the showers were on her first assignment so many years ago, when she was just a cadet aboard the Imperial Star Destroyer Defiance. She grew to like it. The cold water toughened her, woke her up, just like it is now. Plus, it's a necessary contrast with the heat here. Soon as she steps out of the shower, that heat assaults her. Yes, the hot, humid air is invisible, but no less tangible. It feels like she's walking through boiling swamp water, drowning while standing. Out in the luxurious room that the satrap has furnished for Ray, Adia waits. Morning light illuminates her as she stands there, dutiful as a coat rack, a holoscreen in her hand.
"Have you got some sleep?"
Ray asks, toweling off her head.
"Yes, Admiral,"
Adia says, averting her eyes and blushing as Ray dries and dresses herself. Adia isn't true military. Ray sometimes forgets that those outside the Navy or the Army don't share the same experience. Sloane's nudity isn't meant to be anything other than a transitional state. Nothing romantic, nothing shameful. It is a practical fact of existence.
"Good," Sloane says. "Sleep will be necessary for the day ahead."
"I thought the meeting went well."
"The meeting went well the same way a crash landing goes well. It was an ineffective, inconsequential first step."
Ray steps into her uniform, smoothing out the wrinkles. At least that's one good thing the humidity gives her. And her hair looks actually sort of amazing, for the first time in how many years? Appearance figures very little into how she sees herself, but once in a while it's nice to remember what she really looks like.
"We will try again today. That said, I don't expect much. This is just the first summit. We may need more. Bring in more voices. Tell Morna that she should have the shuttle ready just after dinner."
"Of course, Admiral. Do you expect that we will summon the Vigilance back to orbit? Or should Morna plot hyperspace calculations into the shuttle compute?"
Adia's screen flashes. Once, twice, then goes red. Ray furrows her brow.
"What is it now?"
"We have a situation. An incursion."
Chapter 20. The transport buckles and bounces along the cloud tops of Akiva. The sun forms a hot line over the swirling curls of white, looking like melting steel. Down below, the barely seen city of Mira, hidden behind the clouds, and when sight of it emerges, it remains garbed in a gauzy pink haze. Sergeant Major John Burrell of New Republic Special Forces, Spec Forces, looks to the five men and women standing to the right of him at the open door. On their torsos sit carbon lace armor, the shoulders marked with the sigil of the New Republic. The Alliance starboard, now inside a sunburst, the symbol of a changed day, a new dawn, the Phoenix truly reborn.
The soldiers standing here with him, Corporals Kaysen, Strom, Gahia B, Poltnik, and Durs. He knows which is which, even though their faces are concealed behind the orbital drop masks. He gives the nod.
Drop!
One by one, they unclip and leap into the clouds. Slug throwers on their backs, arms stretched out, as if trying to reach for the sun. His turn. Burrell hates jumping. Give him anything else. Anything. Creeping through some Naboo swamp, freezing his tail off in some ice-walled snow base. One time, they had to fly a gunship through an electrical superstorm over Geonosis to root out some Imperials that had gotten it in their heads to start up the old Geonosian droid factories again. The storm was all lightning and heavy winds and hail peppering the side of the craft so hard it left little dents in the metal. He was pretty sure they were dead before they even landed. And that was still better than jumping out of a ship, especially a suborbital drop. Well, it is what it is. Burrell jumps after Durs, the last in the line. It feels like it always does. His guts sucking out through his hind end. His heart left somewhere behind in the sky above him. The panic, the terror, and then the air rocks. A concussive wave hits him. His body spins like a spun top. And above him, he sees it. The side of the transport blown open. Black smoke bellowing as flames flash and sparks shower. The ship lists and starts to tilt as it goes down. He tries to calm, but it's no good. He knows that. There's a calm blackout. Nothing he says is going to go anywhere. Best he can do now is drop and try not to die. But that's a far trickier task than he expected, because below him, he sees Corporal Kaysen and the front of the line disappear in a flash. Something comes up from the ground, the blinding streak from a turbo laser. 1 minute there's Kaysen, and the next, he's just a red spray and a torn-up tatter of carbon lace armor spiraling through the clouds.
We're dead, Burrell thinks.
Another blast, and Strom is next. A flash, and he's gone. Burrell dives down through the space where Strom was just 2 seconds before. Burrell signals the others. We're pigeons to hunt up here. We need to be falcons. Engage para-wings. It's too soon. They're too high up. The winds up here could kill them. But what choice do they have? Below him, the other three snap out their arms and legs, and their wingsuits engage. It's too late for Gahia B. The moment the Kupoan's para-wings extend from wrist to ankle, he's gone. Another searing blast from the surface of the planet, and he's just ragged wing strips caught on the wind. Chapter 21. A quiet morning in Mira. The rains have stopped. Heat rises off the rooftops and streets, leaving everything smeary behind the vapor blur. A pair of cerulean skycatchers duck and dive in the air above Nora's head, chasing one another in what might be a territorial dogfight or a mating dance. Or both, perhaps given the nature of those plucky blue birds. It feels calm up here, on Esmel and Shireen's rooftop as she sips her tea. But the serenity outside does nothing to quell the chaos inside. Nora knows this feeling. Suiting up for her Y-Wing. Sitting there in the hangar on Home 1, waiting for the signal. Waiting for the jump to lightspeed. It was quiet then, too. A few murmured voices here and there. A droid burbling past. The sounds of the old frigate. A tink, tink, tink in the pipes behind the walls. A faint groan of metal on metal. The rumble of the air scrubbers kicking on. She tries not to feel sick. But today is like that day. She just wants to go home. But duty calls once more. Downstairs in the basement, Temin works on the droid. The other two manage some sleep. Nora did as well, though just a few hours, and even those were not without trouble. But the boy kept working. She admires him. He's like his father, single-minded and driven. but he's got her stubborn streak. Her anger, her cocky sure-footedness, the same sure-footedness that made her leave this planet and join the Rebel Alliance under the foolish assumption she alone would be able to find out where they were keeping her husband and... what? Rescue him? Like he was a princess trapped in a tower, like the old fairy tales? What a blubber-headed notion that was. Across the way, up toward the orchard, she sees another rooftop. An older couple sits up there. She recognizes them. They've been here for years, those two. The pair, a couple of old shriveled Bith. She forgets their names, though as Mel probably knows them. The two Bith sit there under an umbrella, watching the sunrise over the distant jungle, sipping from a single cylinder, probably a cup of Orate slurry. Bith seemed to love the stuff. Peaceful people, the Bith. Nora wishes she could be like them. Just then, a sound in the distance. A sound Nora knows deep in her bones before her ears even receive it. The roar of a TIE fighter. It streaks past, flying low, toward the city center. The Bith, peace-loving, Orate-sipping Bith, stand up. The old man has a blaster rifle he yanks out from under his chair. And next thing Nora knows, he screams a babble of profanity in his native tongue before firing futile laser bolts at the screaming Imperial fighter. The Bith woman, she shakes her fist and joins in the tirade. It hits Nora then. Of course. Of course. She's about to turn around and head back inside when out over the city center, an explosion rocks the sky. Nora spins and sees up there in the clouds something burning. A small black shape. A ship. Suddenly listing hard and plunging through the whirling clouds. Another flash. A cannon blast from a turbo laser punches up through the sky. It hits something up there. Something small. A soldier, maybe? Her middle tightens. A rebel soldier? It makes sense. But that means their timetable just changed. With the last hit from the spanner, the battle droid's eyes pulse and flicker back to life. The speaker underneath the thing's pointed metal beak utters a grinding, stuttering sound. Temin hits it again.
Roger, roger!
The droid stands up. Servo motors whir as it regards its repaired arm. An arm that's not so much an arm as it is an astromech leg. It spins the leg around, slow at first, then faster and faster until it's just a blur.
This is not my arm.
I know, Bones. Sorry.
This is an astromech leg.
No, no, I know.
Astromechs are inferior. They are... trash cans. I am made inferior by the inclusion of this non-arm.
Temin shrugs.
I promise I'll get you fixed up when we get back to the shop. Right now, this is what my aunts had around.
Down here in the basement workshop is where he first built Bones, cobbled together from scrapped droids he found in the catacombs beneath the cities. Debris and ruination from the Clone Wars. When the factory down there, now a gutted, flame-charred crater, still pumped out droids for the Separatists. He reaches for the spanner and collapses it. It's a little multi-tool he always keeps at his belt. Can become nearly any tool he needs just by telescoping out different prongs. He twirls it, pops it back on his utility belt.
Perhaps I can still be functional.
The droid thrusts the astromech leg forward.
I can bludgeon those who would hurt you. I will beat them to a greasy treacle paste. Do not worry, Master Temin. You are safe.
Thanks, Bones.
Temin throws his arms around the droid. The droid returns the hug, admittedly with one arm. The astromech leg just kind of pats him on the side of his arm.
I thought I lost you.
He's had Bones for a while now. The thought of losing this droid,
I did good. I came back.
You did. Thanks, Bones.
Roger, roger.
A creak of a board. Someone shifting weight on the plankwood steps. It's his mother. They stare at each other for a few moments, like they don't know how to deal with each other. Because they don't, do they? They're strangers to each other. He realizes that now. He lifts his head. He's embarrassed. Did she see him hug his droid? Ugh.
Mom, you could knock or something next time.
Temin, something has happened, and I think I have a plan.
I'll be right up.
She waits there for a moment.
I'm...
What? Spit it out.
I'm glad we're back together. And I'm glad your droid is fine. He seems to mean a lot to you.
No, he doesn't. He's just a droid, okay? I said I'll be right up.
His mother offers a small smile and nod, then returns upstairs. When she's gone, Temin whispers to the droid.
I didn't mean that.
I know.
You're the best.
I know that too.
Esmel meets her at the top of the steps. Her sister gently closes the door. Worry crosses the woman's face. Her features bunch up like a drawstring cinched tight.
Is the droid okay?
I think so.
Nora neglects to mention the astromech arm that has now replaced his missing one.
Sort of?
That droid means a lot to him.
So I gathered.
No, you don't get it. He built Mr. Bones the year you left. Temin doesn't have many friends. That droid might be it.
You can't be friends with a droid.
Well, he is. Temin was getting taunted and beaten by a gang of young tyrants. Bones protected him. He's not just a bodyguard. When you took off on your trip...
I get it, Nora snaps. You think I should feel bad about leaving? I do feel bad. I felt bad then. I feel worse now. I'm trying to fix things.
And yet, here you are, doing more work for the rebels. It's your son that needs you, Nora. Not this crusade of yours.
Crusade? That's how Esmel sees it? Nora snarls.
War is coming to Akiva, Esme. Not later. Soon. Now, maybe. You can pretend that it won't land on your doorstep, but trust me, you soft-handed, weak-backed sister of mine, no amount of wishing will hold back the tide. Now step aside. I don't have time for this conversation.
Her sister protests, but Nora pushes past her.
Can't I just sit back and watch?
Sinjir says. It's just him and Jazz. In front of them, another display of kitchen implements and foodstuffs. The map of Mira has grown since last night.
All this business is really quite distasteful. I could sit back, hold up scorecards, do a little proper cheerleading.
He takes a nip from the unlabeled bottle. The liquor is sweet. Honey on the front and lavender at the finish. The taste lingering on his tongue is coppery, almost electric, like he's licking the top of a thorium battery.
I told you, I need actual help, not the illusion of help.
Jazz stares at him, sees him drinking. She snatches the bottle out of his hands, sniffs it.
Hey, that's no way to be.
You're a drunk.
I'm no such thing. I'm no drunker than a pickle. I brine myself in order to maintain a low level of...
He waggles his fingers in the air.
Fuzziness. I find life is so much more pleasant that way.
I need you clear.
Oh, he mopes. We're perfectly clear.
The bounty hunter stares holes through him.
What happened to you, on Endor? I do remember you. Standing there, covered in blood. Yours?
He sneers.
I do not want to talk about this.
And yet here we are, talking about it.
She sits down, sighs.
I became a bounty hunter because I did not like the life my mother had chosen for me. It felt overly arranged. It choked me. So I took after my mother's sister. Aunt Sugi was a bounty hunter too. Thing is, Sugi always worked with a crew. She was no lone bird, no rogue operator. One thing I learned from her was, if I was going to work with a crew, I had to trust them. I had to know them. So I didn't work with the crew, because I trusted myself above anyone else. Now here I am, working with you.
Which, let's be honest, makes you very fortunate. I'm really very cool. It's almost as if you've won the Empire Day lottery. He smirks.
Hey, if you have a ship, where is it?
Can't we use it to just flit off this rock?
Go find something better to do?
It's a few days' walk out into the jungle,
she says. But the way she says it indicates that the Zabrak isn't buying any of it.
Had to make sure my trek into the city was unseen.
Convenient, by way of grave inconvenience.
She stares holes through him.
What happened that day? On Endor?
You know what happened. You were there.
To you? What happened to you?
Sinjir puts forth a grim smile, trying not to speak aloud the memories that are tearing him apart.
Fine. You really want to know? You won't stop poking? Let's have it then.
He swirls the honeyed liquid around the bell of the bottle.
So, like I said, I was an Imperial loyalty officer on the base of Endor, and... Oh, look, it's Nora.
He nearly drops the bottle when he sees her step into the kitchen.
Her, Nora, standing right there, fuming, chest rising and falling like that of a beast who smells blood on the wind. He should have heard her come up, but with the drinking and talking...
An Imperial? She says.
I'm sure you misheard me, he says.
I said... Mim-perial.
He frowns and... That's not a word, is it?
An Imperial? She says again, louder this time. Nora, listen. She charges at him, tackles him to the counter.
Bowls clatter. The salt cellar spins off the edge of the table and shatters. Her hands wrap around his throat, and her face hovers over his.
I should have known, she says. You didn't carry yourself like one of us. Too superior. Too nose at the sky. That accent, too. Crisp, like a bitten cracker. You son of a Gundark!
The click of a blaster. Jazz presses it to the side of Nora's head. The bounty hunter speaks in a calm voice.
Nora, you're going to have to make peace with this. If you can't make peace, everything falls apart. He was an Imperial, and we can use him.
It's like watching the mist clear out over lake water. The fight goes out of Nora, and she falls into this thousand-meter stare. Sinjir eases out of her slackening grip and rubs his throat.
We can use him, Nora says. You're right.
Her focus snaps back, and it's as if she's made a decision.
Something has happened. The timeline has changed. We need to move now.
From behind them, Temin says,
Am I interrupting something?
Nobody says anything.
What's going on? Hello? Anybody?
Nora smiles and says, I have a plan.
Interlude. Severkos.
Three slaves huddle in the shadows of Imperial turrets, hiding behind a jagged rock as the battle rages. Hatchet, the Weequay, whose craggy face is marked by a central scar running down between his eyes, down the length of his nose, over his lips, and even to his chin. Palabar, the Quarren, whose tentacled face is chapped and chafed and peeling, for the air here is so dry and full of particulate it will slowly abrade you, sure as water erodes rock. And Greybok, the one-armed Wookiee, a beast who hovers over the both of them and protects them, even as an A-Wing slams into the Red Rock mountainside above, raining debris upon them.
"We must run,"
Hatchet hisses.
"The Imperials are winning this battle, and when they do, the mines will again be theirs. We will again be theirs."
The Quarren nods. Palabar has been so traumatized over the years that he goes wherever the wind takes him, cowering and nodding and whimpering in the dark. Greybok roars, a guttural growl of dissent. He shakes his one fist in rage, baring his teeth as he ululates. The Imperial turrets spit fire across the open plain, leading up to the mouth of the spice mine. Other slaves huddle about, some wounded, others dead, most just trying to survive however they can. Greybok growls again, his head lifting, his filthy matted fur shaking. Hatchet shakes his head.
"You're mad! We cannot help the rebels win! This is not our war, you walking pelt! Our only hope is not to die!"
But in a rare fit of dissent, Palabar says,
What if the Wookiee is right? What if this is our only chance? If we run, they'll find us."
Greybok barks in agreement. He shakes his arm again. The Severco slave masters took his other one many years ago when he tried to escape. Their masters were not themselves Imperials, but this mine has long been in the grip of the Empire. Officers coming to inspect the proceedings, to take a tithing of credits and spice. The Empire does not frown on slaves, but rather was built on their backs. The credits in the Imperial coffers are earned by those who are kept against their will. Whole species. Greybok knows all of this. He is no common worker, but that is his purpose here, to swing a pneumohammer and pulverize rock. Once, he was a tribal diplomat. He knows the rough shape of things. He is no fool. And though he is no warrior, today he has cause to try.
"Don't go out there!"
Hatchet spits.
"Don't be a fool, Wookiee!"
But the Wookiee doesn't care. Greybok just wants to be free. He stands up, roars the battle cry of his people. Then he runs into battle, ducking laser fire. An Imperial in mechanized battle armor wheels on him, turning a heavy handheld cannon toward him. But Greybok has speed and surprise, and gets under his attacker and flings the heavy trooper into a crevasse. Greybok never stops moving. He has a plan. There ahead, a corral. High fence with electrified gate. Inside are three more slaves. These easily 10 times the size of Greybok. Rancors. Creatures made vicious by the slavers. Forced to march in the outer canyons to keep the slaves from attempting escape. Everyone knows that if you did make it to those canyons, the rancors there would hunt you and eat you. But when the Imperials come, the rancors are drawn back to their high fence corral and kept. They don't like anybody, slave or Imperial. The rancors are trained only to like the slavers who train them. These rancors are here now, on the side of the Imperials. They gnash their teeth and scream. One of them is smaller than the others, bright yellow eyes and gray-green face. The others are rust-red, like the mountains in this part of Severkos. Bigger, too. Greybok bolts toward the corral, scooping up a heavy rock as he goes. The rancors turn toward him, shrieking. Greybok roars back and begins to bang the rock against the massive lock holding the electrified gate closed. The rancors stop screaming and watch what he's doing with intense fascination. Imperials start to yell. Laser bolts pepper the ground near his feet and sizzle against the fence. He keeps going. Until the lock cracks in half and drops. The crackling serpents of electricity that once crawled all over the corral fence suddenly flicker and die. The charge is gone, and the gate starts to swing open. The smaller Rancor roars and bats the gate open with the back of its hand. The gate catches Greybok and flings him to the ground. His head cracks against a rock, and everything goes blurry. Above him, dizzy shapes as the three Rancors escape. Screams ensue. Something explodes. Men yelling in panic. Then suddenly, someone appears over Greybok. A slaver. A Zygarian. Mouth twisted up in feral rage. The master seethes.
What have you done, slave?
Greybok tries to stand, but the Zygarian points one of their terrible weapons, a blaster called a Needler. The slaver spins a dial on the side and pulls the trigger. Ropes of red lightning flicker from the tip of the weapon and surround the one-armed Wookiee. Everything is light and pain and fire. He can't even roar. He can only choke and gurgle. Blackness bleeds in at the edges. The Zygarian means to kill him. That is one of the powers of the Needler. It can cause a little pain or a whole lot of it. Enough, over a short period, to seize your heart and kill you. But then, it stops. The fire recedes. The pain fades, though the memory will long remain. The Zygarian drops. There stands Hatchet, holding a bludgeoning rock of his own. Greybok roars a thank you, and then darkness takes him. Though only for a moment, or so he thinks. He opens his eyes, and it feels like no time has passed at all. Except it has. Hatchet sits there, picking his teeth with a broken stick. All around is the waste of war. The turrets of fire. Rebels rounding up slavers. Canisters of spice thrown into a crackling fire. One of the Rancors lies dead. One of the big ones. The gray-green one and the other rust-red monster are nowhere to be found, and no sounds of them can be heard. Greybok roars a question. The Weequay answers,
What happened this? We won! Or the rebels won. Well, somebody won, and it wasn't the Empire or the slavers.
Nearby, Palabar holds his knees close with his long arms. His tentacles search the air anxiously. He asks,
What happens now?
Greybok echoes the question in a low, thrumming grumble. As a rebel soldier passes by, Hatchet calls out to her.
Hey, honey! What happens now? For us, I mean. The slaves!
She smiles a little, but Greybok sees that she looks lost, too. All she can do is shrug.
I don't know. Nobody knows. You're free, though.
The woman keeps on moving. She kicks a stormtrooper helmet out of the way, and then she's gone. In the distance, the sound of another battle. Greybok wonders if all of Severkos will fall, or if it will be reclaimed by the Empire. The future is suddenly unpinned, evolving, spinning, leaping about like a panicked tree lure more. Hatchet laughs a mirthless sound.
Nobody knows. You hear that, fellas? Nobody knows what happens next.
He sniffs and stands up.
Whatever it is, I guess we're the ones who got to do it. Let's walk. We're free now. Might as well act like it. See what the galaxy has to offer a trio of no good, no class ex-slaves. Yeah?
Part 3. Chapter 22. Bleary-eyed Admiral Akbar stands, studying the data. It's a short packet of information, shown in a three-dimensional display. Before him, the surface of the planet Akiva grows bigger, blowing up like a balloon, until it seems like he could reach out and move the whorls of clouds with the flat of his hand, like a god. But it's just a projection, a hologram. Data pulled from the probe droid still there in space. He sees what the droid saw. The small dot, illuminated by a red circle representing the transport flying in. The Spec Force soldiers exiting the ship one by one, each a yellow circle. Then the flash of cannon fire. A turbo laser from the planet's surface. That from somewhere down below the clouds. The red circle flickers and goes dark, exploding in midair before it ever reaches the ground. One by one, the yellow circles flicker and go dark too. Except for one. They lose his signal when he reaches the planet, but it would appear as if Sergeant John Burrell of the Spec Forces survived the attack. To what end, Akbar does not know. Information at this point is and will be sketchy. The communications blackout is doing them no favors. The probe droid only has the information it has because of a visual survey. And they only have the droid's information because it daisy-chained the communique back to the Oculus, which is far enough out of range that it can send it back to Akbar here on the Home One. Short-range communication made long.
"And we think Burrell survived?"
Akbar says. The hologram of Deltura's face nods.
"We do."
He moves aside, and the science officer's face appears. Officer Nirian says,
"Though his survival is not guaranteed, you'll note the erratic pattern he suddenly follows. A pattern that continues to the ground."
She replays that last bit, where Burrell's glowing circle suddenly darts right, then left, then zigzags down.
"It suggests he deployed the Parawing too early. The wind at that level is intense. We cannot be certain that the man who landed on the surface is a man who is alive and well."
Akbar nods.
"Thank you, Officer Nirian. Commendable work, as always."
He cranes his neck and massages it. Deltura returns.
"Sir, our orders, Admiral?"
"Remain in place until further order. But remain wary. Something is going on there. It seems we will have to reveal the face of this thing with a far more active hand than initially anticipated."
If this is the Empire, as their shadowy informant suggests, then the war for the galaxy has preemptively come to this sector of the Outer Rim. They already know by the time she gets to the room. The volume level of those present is already a clamorous din. And when Rey enters through the door, that vexed and fretful outcry turns toward her like a laser. The satrap, acting like a servant, hurries toward her, and he's saying, not to her, but to those gathered,
"I told you, it's safe, it's safe. The walls here are stone as thick as you are tall."
He gets to Rey and offers her a tray full of fragrant pastries, delicate little pinwheels with sweet floral fruit pressed into the centers. She hand waves them away. Despite the hungry protestations of her stomach, she cannot seem like an effective leader if she has a funny little confection in her hand and crumbs at the corners of her lips. No, better yet, how best to downplay the severity? She catches the satrap by the arm and plucks a pastry from the tray and begins to eat it. Let them see she doesn't take this threat seriously. A lie. It's serious. Or will be dire enough soon enough. The fact they already know something's going on is again a credit to Pandion. He has someone on the inside of her team. Tothwind? Could be. The Pratt. Adia or Morna? That, a more troubling concern. Nothing to be done now. No time for a rat hunt. She waves her hand, catching a few falling crumbs in the palm of her hand.
"As you know,"
she starts to say, then has to say it louder again to quiet those gathered.
"As you know, there has been an incursion into Akivan space. We discovered a rebel transport in the atmosphere above Mira. We eradicated that transport with one of the suborbital ground-to-orbit cannons. That is the end of our present concerns."
"The end?"
Crassus barks.
"That feels hardly accurate. How dismissive! This is a threat, Admiral Sloan. The Rebel Alliance..."
Pandion interrupts.
The rebels will send a fleet. Not immediately, but soon. And when they do, we should meet them here. They are blind to the situation, yet we see with clear eyes. That gives us a powerful advantage. They send a fleet, and we have our own. Led by the Super Star Destroyer Ravager, of course. Waiting. A victory for the Empire. One that will serve as a tolling bell, ringing throughout the galaxy, heralding the return of order.
Tashu and Crassus nod. Shale says, elbowing past the obsequious satrap and his tray of pastries,
"They still have the military advantage, particularly if they send in a large fleet as a response. How likely that is, I cannot say, but just the same, putting any of our command ships into play right now is foolhardy. This battle has no stakes except that of our survival. That is a battle you only fight if you must. If we lose this, then we lose our command ships, and likely our lives or our freedoms. That will be a tolling bell, Moff Pandion. Do you want to lose here as you did on Malastare? The loss of that communication station lost us our meager hold on that world."
She too heard of his loss there. Only he escaped, fleeing in an escape shuttle as the rebels took the base behind him. In the Navy, the Admiral goes down with the ship. Moffs do not hold such a code, it seems. Bringing it up has stung Pandion. His anger at the comment hangs on his face like an ugly mask.
"You coward!"
Shale shrugs.
"Not so much of a coward that I fled, as my men fell to capture or death."
It's time to step in before these two kill each other. Though that, she thinks, might solve a problem, wouldn't it? If only she were so ruthless.
"The plan as I see it,"
she again says quite loudly, "is that we continue breakfast and continue discussing our greater purpose. The future of the Galactic Empire and the galaxy it ostensibly controls. In the meantime, our people will prepare our shuttles, pack our things, and my assistant Adia will plot for us a revised location for this meeting. By lunchtime, we will adjourn to that secondary location and continue this there." That statement is her trying to put her boot down on the neck of a wriggling serpent, to pin it to the ground before it bites her. This whole thing threatens to be a rope sliding all the way through her grip. Right now, her declarative statement seems to give them pause, but she knows at any moment someone like Pandion will step forward, call a vote. That, a precedent from the night before, and a mistake she made letting them all have a voice. And here she wonders at the larger mistake. Is this meeting a foolhardy endeavor? Perhaps Pandion has a point. The Empire needs an emperor, not some squabbling council. Councils are how you slow the wheels of progress to an imperceptible crawl. The Galactic Senate was known for its inability to accomplish anything. It is what it is.
"Let our meeting commence," she says. John Burrell coughs. His eyes refocus. Where is he? What happened?
It doesn't take long for it to come careening back, fast as the ground lunging up to meet him. The memory of falling, the transport in flames. His team erased from the sky, one by one, as if by the flicking finger of a callow and callous god. And him, his wings out, the wind taking him. Durs below him, Polnitschk above him, a laser erasing Durs, the wind breaking Polnitschk before the cannon claims him, too. Jom fell into it. Then a jet stream of air, pushing hard, a cold wind that swept him aside like a brutish hand. He dropped about 30 meters in a few seconds, then tumbled forward, the air gone from under his wings. He blacked out, only to awaken again, closer to the ground now, the city visible beneath him. He extended his arms once more, felt the air seize him. His descent was ill-controlled. He crashed into the side of a small wagon, and then crawled underneath a small wooden overhang strewn with hay and fruit rinds, the leavings of some domesticated animal, before passing out into what he feared might be death. But alive, he remains. It's hot as a rancor's mouth here.
Chom pries off his mask, flings it to the ground. He tries to move, but his one arm gives out, and pain fires from the wrist to the shoulder like an arc whip of electricity. He can't even close his fist.